That's the case first here then of Rickard Höglund. This is, of course, very close to the name Richard Hoagland, but people shouldn't shouldn't make the connection to the name here. Tell us when you got involved with this case, when you heard about this, and then a little bit later, maybe we can just kind of break down about exactly what happened and how much you know about the case.
Yeah. Well, first of all, this is the most interesting and also the most complicated UFO contact case I have ever investigated, and I have spent several years documenting this. I first heard of this in 1972 when I was just 20 years old and very new into ufology from some friends here in Sweden. And I, from the beginning, I thought this was a very fascinating contact because it was very physical and there were many people involved, and it was unusual in that respect that here you had a Swedish man who obviously worked for these aliens, whoever wherever they come from, whoever they are. And so I started to gather material to document this as much as I could, and I continued with this during the years and tried to interview as many witnesses as I could. But of course I was very young when I started doing this, and the main witness, Richard Höglund, he died in 1977. I only had a short telephone conversation with him, unfortunately. But basically, this story started in 1965. Richard Höglund, he was a Swedish worker, a rock blaster by profession, and he lived in Uddevalla, not far from Gothenburg, with his wife and a dog. And he was on sick leave here. He had trouble with his kidneys, a stone, kidney stone. Mm-hmm. And so he was home from work, and it was on the December the 9th, 1965, which was a very cold day. And he decided to take his car to a lake called Grindhultsjön, about 8 kilometers east of Uddevalla, for a walk with the dog. And he takes the dog on to the lake. There is ice on the lake there. And suddenly his dog starts running around in circles like mad, so he had to put a leash on it. And he hears a sound in the sky, like a whining sound in the air. And as he looks up, he notices an object, a round or saucer-shaped object, about 5 meters in diameter and 3 meters in height, which is spiraling down on the ice, not very close to him, coming down. And the first thought was that this must be some Russian cosmonauts or something. And the object comes, it doesn't land on the ice, it hovers a little bit above the ice, and under this object, there is a tube lowered by some a dark tube, and with some material made of soft material, which is moving in the wind. And he is close enough to feel a breeze of hot air from this. And a funny thing is that this air has a smell of flowers, of hyacinth, mm-hmm. it's called. So he's just looks at this, and suddenly you see 4 people coming down this tube like on an invisible elevator, and come down on the ice, and they come up to him. And when they are quite close to him, he can see that they are no ordinary people. They are 3 men and 1 woman. And the very strange thing about this is that they are enclosed in some form of transparent overall or some plastic overalls, which looks like they are air pressured from within.
Mm-hmm.
And what is very special, of course, they are totally naked under this. And he, of course, really don't know what to think about this. They come up to him and start a sign conversation. They were basically normal in the way that they normal height, like people, but they have very large dark eyes. Some, they were somewhat slanted eyes, somewhat oriental, and they were perfect in a way. They were perfect teeth, they were perfect skin, there were no blemishes, they were absolutely hairless. No hair on their bodies, not even genital hair. But they looked like people generally.
Mm-hmm.
With one exception then, their ears were rather large and a little bit pointed. And the hole into the head was larger than on ordinary humans. He compared it to looking at a cat. You can see quite, if you look at a cat, you can see almost inside the head.
Right.
Yeah. And they start to a sort of conversation there, gesticulating and writing in the snow and so on. And he is not really afraid of them. They seem friendly. They point to his hair and seem to be very fascinated by his hair. He has to remove his cap several times, and they laugh and point at his hair, which is obviously very strange to them. When he tried to touch their overalls or their plastic covers, then they moved away very quickly. They didn't want to be touched, and they had a small black package, which they sprayed some form of gas on everything they touched themselves. For instance, the girl started playing with the dog, and before she played with the dog, she sprayed him with this gas, or whatever it was. Richard thought it was very strange, because the dog was usually very aggressive. But this girl, she played with the dog, and it was no problem.
So there's some kind of disinfectant or something like that they probably spray
out
there?
Yeah, probably, yes. Yeah, it looks like some form of disinfectant, yes. and another thing, they didn't walk on the ground. It was like they floated a little bit above the ground when they weren't. They were not on. There was like an invisible air under their feet when they walked. They had some form of broad black bracelets with a yellow button on their left wrists. And when they touched this, which they did occasionally, it seemed to have something to do with this weightlessness. That was his experience. And they tried to communicate here, and there is one man who is older, and the two men are obviously very young, and the girl is also quite young. And the old man, he explains that he knows something about this earth. He shows how you hunt with a bow and arrow, and they try to converse about basic things on this planet.
Sorry to interrupt, but do you know if this was in Swedish then? Was it telepathic nature, or is it still with the signs on the ground?
No, he doesn't say it was telepathic. They drew figures in the snow, and they gesticulated, and they tried to, no telepathy here. So he didn't mention that anywhere. When they had talked for a while, Richard felt that his pain in the kidneys affected him. And this was noticed by this older man. So he goes back to the craft and up in the ship again, and comes back with a small cylinder.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes behind Richard and sort of let it sort of glide on his back, or touches his back. And then the pain just is gone away. He doesn't feel the pain anymore. This is interesting, because we know today we have a technology that you can, by sound waves, destroy kidney stones. So that's my speculation, of course, that maybe they did something to him that simply destroyed these stones, because he had been to the doctor and been x-rayed, and they have found that he had stones in his kidneys, which of course troubled him.
Do you know if this later then was confirmed in any way, like by the doctor, that it was just removed or gone after this point?
Yeah, and that's interesting. I corresponded with the doctor in Uddevalla who did this investigation, and he had an x-ray before this happened, and I have got all the data on this. It shows clearly he has some stones in the kidneys. And after this, he did a new x-ray on, I think, the 20th of December, and there is absolutely nothing left in the kidney. It's like it's never been a stone in the kidney. So something did happen, whatever. It just disappeared, and his pain disappeared. If there was some natural way it could have gone out, I don't know, but it was gone, simply.
Yeah. You mentioned Helge before. This is Helge. This is what he was called, before he I guess he came up with his real name, right? This was actually covered in some of the newspapers at the time, and it's called Helge.
Yes.
Helge Case.
Yeah. Yeah. It took some time before I mentioned his real name. Then we called him Helge. So it's known as the Helge Case in Sweden, but his actual name was Richard Höglund, of course.
What was some of the? Have you gone through some of the newspaper coverage of this in the early days there?
You mean if there were other observations that day or something?
No, if this was touched upon by some of the local press in the area, or did he contact anybody about this newspapers?
Yeah. Well, what happened after this? Is much more to this. They leave eventually, though, of course, and this craft leaves, and he goes home, and he didn't dare to tell his wife during the first days what had happened. He thought it was so strange, actually. But after a few days, he had heard about UFO organizations. There was a UFO organization in Stockholm called Ufologiska Sällskapet, Ufological Society, and he contacted a man that is the chairman there, and he came down for an interview, and I have this interview on tape, which is one of the basic documentations on this case.
Mm-hmm.
So, shall we continue with his?
I guess so, because there's a lot more to it. Did you?
Oh, yes.
Just remind me again, though, Håkan. Did you interview Richard personally?
Yes, only one time in 1973. I phoned him, and he said he was not allowed to tell anything about this. He said it will probably be known in the future, but he had been told not to tell anybody about this. It was I think he was afraid, but that was I heard from other people. And he didn't want to talk about it. So he said he had written a book about it himself. He had a manuscript, but I have never seen this, and it's probably gone if he ever wrote about it.
Was he told not to talk about this by the contacts he had with the people, those people?
Yes.
Or,
by these aliens. He was told that not to talk about this. He had talked quite a lot to several ufologists in the beginning after this first experience. But he was told that he should not do this. They didn't like it, he said.
So phone interview, Håkan, that's obviously a little bit different from meeting in person and so, but still, though, your overall impression when you talked of him, stable, all that, or how did he come across to you at the time?
Yeah, he seemed like any normal man. It was quite okay. And, of course, I have several sources then for his experiences. One, his best friend, which was called Gösta Johansson, is one of my main sources to this, who he told just about everything to. And I have interviewed many, many people who knew him, of course, and some of his closest friends also.
So what about his wife, though, as well? She knew a little bit eventually, is that correct?
Yeah, eventually he told about this, and she believed him, but thought, of course, it was very strange because he knew that he was a down-to-earth person. He really well, he was a rock blaster and a worker, you know, he was down to earth in many respects.
Right.
So she thought it was very strange, of course. Mm-hmm. And there was one funny thing. When he came home from this first experience, he smelled of flowers. He smelled of hyacinth. So his wife asked him, have you bought flowers for the Christmas already? And, of course, he had to say, no, I haven't. So he couldn't tell that it came from the craft, of course.
Oh, it's from an alien craft, I just, yeah.
So, that's a funny little thing.
That's
about
right. So there are some twists and turns, the continuous up of this story. So let's kind of proceed and talk about what happened next here, Håkan.
Yeah. He continued working as a rock blaster, and in August 1966, which was about a year later then, he worked north of Uddevalla, and during the night when he was going home the next day, he felt very strange. He felt like he was almost forced to get up and go to the car and go back to the lake where he had his first contact. He said it was like almost somebody else drove my car. And so he dressed and he drives down to this lake one more time. And when he comes there, he observes there is a craft hovering over this lake again. And he can also see that there is a man standing beside the craft, but he's standing in the air like he was not affected by gravity, like he was weightless there. And there is a small boat there, and he takes this boat out just a few meters and out to this man. And they start a conversation. And now they speak Swedish, but the strange thing is that he doesn't hear it from his lips, but the sound comes from the craft a little bit after he has spoken, like they were some form of synchronized, some form of technical
translator device, what have you?
Yeah, some type of translator device, yes. So the words came a little bit slightly afterwards. And here Richard is informed or asked if he wants to cooperate with these people because there is, they say there is a war maybe coming, that the United States will possibly attack China, they say, and we need to start a peace movement. We would like your help. And he is also given a small plate, a metal plate with some hieroglyphics on, strange signs on, that he is told to keep all the time. But of course, Richard says, I don't know English. I'm just an ordinary worker. I don't want to do this, because he is also told to go to their base in the Bahamas for education. And of course he says, that's impossible. I work here, I have a wife, and I don't want to go to the Bahamas. So he thinks this is just nonsense.
Right.
Yeah, so they talk for a while, and he takes the boat back to the shore. And as he thinks this, the whole story is just crazy. Small plate he buries in the ground, in the woods there, beside the lake, and he goes home after this. And then after this, he starts thinking about all this, and he tells his wife, and he changes his mind. After a while, as they have obviously cured him for his sickness, he feels maybe I should help them. And so he starts discussing with his wife, perhaps I should go to the Bahamas and see what it's all about. But of course, his wife says this is crazy. I will never leave my home, and she doesn't like it at all. Of course, she's protesting against this. But I say I think I have to go. This is important. He feels sort of some form of obligation to them because they have helped him then.
Mm-hmm.
What happened next is he goes down. He has two daughters from a former marriage, and he goes down. They live in Göteborg, Gothenburg. And a couple of months after this, he goes to visit them, and he takes his car. And on his way home, he picks up this plate. He goes to the lake, picks up the plate, and when he stops at the gas station to fill up the car with gas again, a man comes up to him who looks like a priest or a Catholic priest. He has a dark clothes, dark cape and things like that, and he asks if he can go with him. And he says, well, it's okay, you can go with me. And after a while, this man asks, do you recognize me? And now I think I've left some out in this to make it understand it.
Oh, okay, do you need to go back again maybe?
Yes.
Yeah, sure.
Yes, that's right. that's right. Of course, the first time that they went to the Bahamas in March 1967 for the first time. I forgot that.
Right, so they actually went, both Richard and his wife?
Yeah, he convinced her that, well, we simply have to go. And so they sold everything they had. They sold the car. They had to kill the dog and sell everything they had because to go to the Bahamas, they were just ordinary workers and didn't have so much money. And they went to the Bahamas and to an island called Little Exuma. And there nothing happened because he hadn't the plate with him this time. Because of that, we learn later that nothing happened. So he wrote in the sand, I have been here, and his name, and then they have to go home again.
So did they detail to him exactly where to go in the Bahamas?
Yeah, he was going to a beach in Little Exuma, and there to meet all these aliens. But he hadn't the plate with him, and nothing happened, so they had to go home again, which of course was very bad for that. They couldn't go back to Uddevalla. They didn't know what the neighbors would say. That would be very strange. Richard had a brother in Stockholm, so they moved into his apartment in Stockholm, and after a while he also got a job as a rock blaster in Stockholm, so they could settle down a little bit there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it was now that he decided to go and fetch the plates and visit his daughters at the same time. When he met this guy who looked like a priest, he said that you forgot the plate the last time you were there. So he was obviously one of them somehow.
Was this encounter in Stockholm or in Uddevalla?
No, it was when he stopped at a gas station. And this man came up to him and asked for a lift. And obviously he was one of them, because he knew what had happened in the Bahamas.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And he said, you forgot the plate, and that was not very good. Now you have to go again, and you have to take the plate with you this time.
Oh, jeez. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's the second time they went. It was in December 1968.
So a few years after her, basically, yeah?
Yeah. And, of course, then several people had got involved in this case in various ways, because he was ordered to start a peace movement in Sweden. And he tried to start an ordinary organization, a peace movement here. Mm-hmm. And it was actually started by a man in Nyköping. And this organization was called the New Generation, to work for peace on Earth and things like that. And there were several UFO-interested people involved in this from the beginning. And there was also one man here who had quite a lot of money, and he said, "I can, if this is very good, I can finance another trip to the Bahamas, if this is something very good." And so they go to Bahamas once again in December 1968. And this time he has to plate with him. And he has been ordered that they should live in Nassau in the Bahamas. And on the New Year's Eve, he has to go down to the beach and meet a special man who is called Joe, a colored man, who will be waiting with a boat to take him to their base in the Bahamas. Hmm. And he does so. He goes to this meeting and meet this man, and there's also a girl there, and they go out in this boat, and he doesn't know how far out they go, but eventually they come to some mountain or some island, which there is a cave which they go into, and there they have a base, obviously, where he is to be taught various things. And he says it was very large, and he saw other entities there, some like us and some, well, very different from us, he said. And there he says he was taught what he was to do, but he says very little of this. I haven't been finding out very much about it, actually.
This is, in other words, nothing you have looked at on a map to see where this could be. It's off from Nassau, you said, but you don't know exactly where, is that right?
No. And he said something also that he didn't want actually to tell the exact location of the base, so probably it wasn't where he's so outside Bahamas. It could have been somewhere else around there, as he didn't want to, well, disclose where the base was, actually.
Right.
Yeah. And when he came home to his wife after this, he was very agitated. He said it was such an experience that it was hard for him to describe. But he has also said that he didn't want to tell so much to his wife, because she was not really a part of this, and he was afraid also for these beings or entities. They were pretty tough, he said. They were not, you couldn't say no to them, sort of.
Ah, interesting.
Yeah. And this makes him a little bit different from all the other contactees who were more missionary and saying that they are good guys, they are here to help us and so on. But Richard said many times that he really didn't trust them. He didn't know if they were the good guys or the bad guys. And this makes him very different from ordinary contactees. He said he felt more forced to work for him, like there was some secret organization in some way.
Interesting. So obviously this is not an abduction case, but it's a voluntary process from Richard's side, and he agrees to all this. And it's more of a contact experience, but yet at the same time he feels that there's an element of being forced just to go along with the orders that they give him, basically.
Yeah, no, that's right. He doesn't really trust them. He said, "I don't know." He said to one of his friends, "I don't know if these are devils or angels, really." But he said they were pretty tough, and they had a lot of money, like some form of, well, almost mafia organization or something.
Interesting.
So he really didn't know what to think, but he was ordered to start a peace movement. But at the same time, they wanted money from this organization. to be sent to them, because they said they had other contactees in Japan, in the Soviet Union, in the United States, and they had formed organizations which gave money to this group. So they obviously wanted money from him also.
Really? But there was other humans involved in this as well, you said?
Yes, of course, when you have a case like this, which is so fantastic, you must ask yourself, of course, was he simply a myth maker? Was he a drug addict, or was there something else behind it? But I interviewed his wife several times, Gunvor, and she died in 1997.
Mm-hmm.
She also met these aliens several times and said, well, yes, he did work for these people, but she was very afraid of them. And she even when she talked to me several years after this, she's afraid to say too much. She really didn't want to reveal too much about what happened. She seemed afraid even many years after this had happened, which is rather strange, I think.
Obviously, there's more I want to ask you about this, but in a little bit here, Håkan, we're going to take a break, and then I want to carry on in the next segment and talk more about this and some other things as well. But overall, though, is it believable to you, the whole story? Could there be, let's say, that there's partial truth but additions to it, or do you feel that the whole thing is the real deal? What do you think?
In my book, I have put up five theories about this. Basically, I say, yes, he did. He was involved with a secret group or with someone, and he did some secret work for whoever these people were. But, of course, there are problems here. For instance, there could have been a sort of false flag operation, or it could have been a front for some other activity. I mean, he could have been involved in some international crime organization or espionage or something that this was a cover for something else. But I really don't know this, of course. He was involved with a group, whoever they were or where they come from. That is clear, because there were several people who can confirm this, and his wife, of course, confirmed it also. And there are so many other parts of this, which it's a long story, of course. So, yes, he did. He was involved in something secret. That's very clear. And I think he was involved with some secret group doing something, which I don't know what their agenda is, but it seems like some form of aliens were involved. But, of course, that's my theory. I can't prove it, of course.
Yeah, well, what a strange and interesting story this one is, though. And there are a few... It seems like the UFO stories we get in the early days, in a sense, if I can put it that way, Håkan, seems to be the most spectacular, and they seem to kind of simmer down into the classical gray abduction scenario more and more after the 60s and 70s in a way. I know there are some different stories out there as well, but interesting.
Yeah. This is very physical, and it's very concrete in many respects. And one thing I didn't mention was that he also claimed to have flown with him, with a craft, several times to bases they had, not just in the Bahamas, but in Mexico and in Central America. And my friend, who knew him very well, was so surprised that he was an ordinary man with almost no money, and in the middle of the winter, he suddenly had a very good suntan. So, obviously, he had been away for several weeks somewhere, doing something. And, of course, if you were an ordinary worker in the 1960s, you didn't have much money. You certainly couldn't go around the world.
Right.
So,
right.
Someone took him somewhere or gave him money to do this.
Interesting. So, obviously, these and many other aspects is some of the things I want to talk more with you about when we return after the break. But for our Swedish listening audience and those who are versed in the Swedish language, you can look into the book Främlingar på vår jord. This means strangers on our earth. And this is, where would you recommend people to go, Håkan, to pick up a copy of the book, to read more?
Well, you can go to the nearest library. Many libraries in Sweden have this book. So you can order it from Youth for Sweden, from our national organization.
All right, excellent. We're obviously going to link up your websites and your blogs. The AFU website is in English, obviously, primarily, right?
Yeah.
There's a Swedish section there, but yeah.
Yeah, basically, because we are working, doing our work, basically international work. So that's it's in English, yes.
That's right. And then you have two blogs that we're going to link up as well. Is that something you want to mention right now as well for our Swedish audience, Håkan?
Okay. Oh, yes, that's quite right, yes.
So ufoarchives.blogspot.com. And then you also have a Google site, ufologist52. It's a somewhat more difficult URL, so I'm going to just link that up so you guys can check it out in the links below to the radio program. But before we take a short break here now, then, is there anything else you want to mention before we do that, Håkan?
Well, you can say on my homepage you also have some English articles in English that could be interesting.
Ah, excellent. Okay, go and check that out as well then for some English stuff. I think primarily we have English audience here, that's why we do it in English, but we like to focus on the Swedish stuff, of course, because that's our home base here at the moment. So, okay, in regard, good stuff. Håkan, stay with us. We'll take a short break and we'll return with more after this.